Thank you, Pete. Well, first of all, on behalf of Ted and I, let me thank you all for inviting us here tonight. Thanks to Peter and Trevor for their kind words of introduction. What I'm going to do is just say a couple more words about Ted and I, just to give you a little bit of a better flavor about why it is we're here together this evening with you. As Peter said, Ted is a Lutheran pastor, professor at Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary, part of the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. And I'm, of course, a molecular biologist, but now a philosopher of science with a joint appointment at the GCU in the Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology. Ted is a Lutheran. I'm a Roman Catholic. Ted is an ordained minister. I'm a member of the lay branch of the Dominican Order of the Catholic Church, just sort of to fill out that picture of who we are and how we happen to come here. Now, the protocol for this evening is going to get a little dizzying because Ted and I are going to dance back and forth to the podium, exchanging the recording microphone as we do it. But in the end, we hope that you will experience sort of an unfolding of our position on these issues that we've come here to discuss with you, that is on the evolution controversy, as some people like to call it, but more what we want to do is explore evolution with you, what that is, explore some of the other challenges, we might say, to evolution, specifically creationism and intelligent design, and then in the end come to what we hope is a useful position that we will espouse. So let me turn this over to Ted now to give you a brief introduction.
Let's ask the question, why is it that evolution is so controversial? Have you ever stopped to think that the other sciences don't seem to be controversial? Astronomy and chemistry and these sciences, mathematics. Have you ever heard anybody come home from a chemistry lab and say, I discovered a formula today that's just shaken my faith? And I think that doesn't happen. But evolution is a hot spot. Why? And our suggestion is there's a historical reason why. Darwin's theory of evolution was born in controversy and continues to be in controversy right down to the present time. Take a look at our little description there. We've got this oil well. We're digging for the science of Darwinism, but look at all the layers of ideology we have to get to in order to get to it. It was November 24, 1859 that Charles Darwin published The Origin of the Species by Natural Selection. Within 24 hours, he got a letter from Thomas Huxley. And Huxley said, I've read your book. Well, if you know that book, it's a pretty long book. I've read your book, he said. And you know what? With your science, we can now fight against the Church of England. So here we have a man who wanted to oppose Christianity, and this is the science that he could use in the weapon against it. And Richard Dawkins, who was mentioned on the ISCAST programs, says, Charles Darwin made it possible for me to be an atheist. So we have this tradition from 24 hours right down to the present day that Darwin's theory and atheism go hand in hand. Well, take a look about the doctrine of progress. The 19th century was filled with progress. Many people still believe it today. It's tough for a Christian theologian to believe in progress, but progress definitely energizes the advance of technology. And Darwin's theory of evolution was ambiguously related to progress. On the one hand, evolutionary biologists today refuse to grant that there is such a thing as progress, yet the word evolution in the popular vocabulary comes to mean progress. Oprah Winfrey on television says, I'm evolving every day. So put that together with social Darwinism, which actually predated Darwin. And according to this theory, we want to provide ethical support for laissez-faire capitalism. And the concept of the survival of the fittest was formulated by Herbert Spencer to refer to economics. And in the third edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species, he says, what I mean by natural selection is what Dr. Spencer means by survival of the fittest. So what you got in the last half of the 19th century was a marriage of science, economics, and ethics, and the justification for the wealthy, money-making people to ignore the plight of the poor. In fact, in Spencer, you can find, we can leave the poor to die on the roadside because they are unfit. Well, are you going to have a Christian reaction to that? Of course you are. Nobody wants a society that is riddled with an ethic that lacks compassion. The eugenics movement, begun by Charles Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton. So if evolution has progressed to give us the human race, reasoned Francis Galton, couldn't we kind of help evolution along a little bit? Couldn't we make the human race better if we could get the right people to have lots of babies and the wrong people not to have babies? So we get positive eugenics and negative eugenics, which spread rapidly. It was the liberal doctrine in England, France, Belgium, Germany, and the United States, the eugenics movement. And tied to the eugenics movement was racism, because they could take that evolutionary bush and they could rank the races according to those that were more highly evolved and the least highly evolved. And of course, the race most highly involved was the English gentleman, right? And everyone else was inferior. And so the eugenics movement led, at least in our country, in America, to the sterilization of people who were poor, people who were mentally retarded or physically handicapped. And in Germany, it led to what? The racial hygiene program. It led to gas chambers and the death of people who were born physically handicapped and mentally handicapped, and eventually the Jews. Why? All in the name of social Darwinism. So when we take a look at this history, it's a pretty bad history. Yet when Marty goes into his laboratory to study, what does he want to do? He wants to take a look at mutations. He wants to take a look at viruses. He wants to take a look at what's going on under that microscope. And he's not interested in atheism or social Darwinism or eugenics. Not at all. You have to drill to get to the good science. I noticed in the opening here the dedication of ISCAST to dealing with Christian doctrine in light of the theoretical basis of science and technology. Pretty much, I think that's what we're after. And one of the themes in our work is the Christian faith demands the best science. Not pseudoscience, not the ideologies, but really good science is an authentic expression of the Christian faith, as well as it is any expression, any commitment to intellectual honesty. So what we want to do first and foremost is to distinguish between Darwinism as a science, which is credible and valuable, and the layers of ideology which are well worth offering a theological and moral critique. What is science? I'm going to call Marty back.
Thanks, Tim. So before we begin discussing the sort of ideological reactions, we'll say, let's sort of get on the same page about what we're talking about. And the first thing I want to do is just sort of make sure we all agree about what science is, maybe specifically what biology is. And let me offer for you a couple of definitions. I'm going to start by saying that science is a systematic way of viewing the natural world. In this sense, what I mean is that biological science, for instance, is a way of seeing. So we would say the biologist's point of view, the scientist's point of view. Now, that's not to say it's a privileged point of view or it's the only point of view, but it is a point of view, just like there are other points of view when other disciplines view the natural world. Secondly, science is an application of a method, such as the hypothetical deductive method, to notice specific aspects of the natural world. Okay? The method can be applied to specific aspects of the natural world. So in this sense, biology is a human activity. It's something that we do. Okay? We have a view, it's something that we do. And then finally, we could say it's a body of knowledge that's been gained by applying that method, again, to specific aspects of the natural world, aspects which will yield to the method, right? And so in this sense, we say science is an area of study. So a student might say, I'm majoring in biology, meaning I'm learning that discipline that is defined by this body of knowledge gained by this method. Now, the task of science is really to create a model of what's out there as reality. I'm taking that position as a philosopher who's a critical realist. So a critical realist argues that there is a reality out there, and science tries to approximate that as the best explanation the model can generate. And the models that we build, also read for that series, have some very special functions. One function is it has to explain the observations. So when you see things in the natural world that are behaving in a certain way, you can eventually, after experimentation, make a theory or a model that explains it. The second function would be that the model has to then suggest new experiments by which we arrive at new knowledge. So the model, we say, is fruitful. And as long as it remains explanatory and fruitful, it continues to be the model we use, until things start arising that begin to challenge the model, and then we see a revolution. We see a paradigm shift, as Thomas Kuhn called it, okay? And we saw that with the Copernican revolution and the quantum revolution, and I might even maintain that biology is today going through such a revolution. We can talk about what the nature of that is later. But the important thing here is that the model, the theory that we build, has these very important features and is well supported by data. And that's basically what Darwin did after he returned from his voyage on the Beagle. He had made observations. And then coming back to London and ultimately to Downhouse in Kent, he began to look at those observations, began to talk to colleagues in the sciences, and formulated a model. And he said, I can explain all current existing species on the planet by the idea that they all descended with modification from some common ancestor, and that this happened through the force of something he called natural selection that influenced the reproductive success. Now, he used the word natural selection in a very conscious way to distinguish it from artificial selection, which is, he said, what we do when we breed animals and plants for special purposes. If we want a sheep that makes more wool, we let those sheep with more wool breed and prevent the ones that don't have more wool from breeding. So he says nature does the same thing. It rewards with reproductive success those organisms which happen to have fitness in that particular environment. He said as a result then, all current species descend from some common ancestor over a long span of time. And now he's thinking in geological time, which was now becoming to be understood by geologists like Charles Lyell in London. Now, this is the model he presented in his 1859 work, and it was the model that then had the reactions we were talking about earlier. But scientifically, the model didn't really come to fruition right away because Darwin had no idea how inheritance worked. No one at the time did, except this monk who was working in Austria at the time, doing his experiments with pea plants and publishing in 1868 and 1869 his theory or his model for heredity. Of course, nobody really accepted it right away. It took another 40 or 50 years. By the time Mendel's laws of genetics were being promulgated, then Darwin's theory was wedded with that, along with understandings about mutations and the like, And we have what is now the common paradigm of biology, the overarching paradigm, which Julian Huxley called the modern synthesis, and which we call the neo-Darwinian synthesis. Okay? Now, it's a very powerful theory. It's a very powerful model. It's very explanatory, and it's well supported by all kinds of data, from the fossil record that Darwin examined, from phylogenetics and cladistics, and even to the molecular data that we're collecting today of genomics and proteomics. Everything is explained by this common model. So it's very potent, very powerful, and it's very, very fruitful. In 2005, in December, Science, the organ of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, named evolution the breakthrough of the year. This is in 2005. You know, he published it in 1859. What's going on here? Well, the reason is that they wanted to emphasize the fruitfulness of this model. And in this issue of the journal that month, they highlighted several very key developments in biology that would not have happened in the absence of this theory. So, for instance, these are stickleback fish. Where's my image, Ted? Oh, there it is, the stickleback fish. And back up a little bit. Oh, the stickleback is buried under there, so I'll just talk about it. Don't need to see a picture. Stickleback fish exist in a couple of species, some that grow in salt water, live in salt water, some that live in fresh water. And when the genomic sequences of these different species were examined, it was discovered that a very simple mutation accounted for the difference in species, a change in one of those very powerful morphogenetic sequences that are present in a lot of different animals. And so it fits very well with this model of gradual selection after genetic changes by mutation. The chimpanzee is the next one on the list. And of course, the chimpanzee genome was sequenced that year and compared to the human genome. And it turns out they're our closest relatives on the planet. We'll share about 98.5 to 99% sequence within the DNA, the expressed DNA of the chimpanzee. That's not important to say that chimpanzees are humans or humans are chimpanzees. It's important in this way. Turns out the chimpanzee has some very interesting medical history. For instance, they don't get Alzheimer's. They don't have heart disease. And they don't respond to the AIDS virus in the same way that humans do. So medical science is thinking we ought to look closely at chimpanzees since we're so close to see medically why it is we have different responses in these different disease states. You would never think that if you didn't think that evolution was in action here. You'd never think to look at chimpanzees with respect to humans if in fact you thought we had separate origins. So it's a very powerful use of the model is to begin to examine chimpanzees to help our own medical situation. And finally, in my own field, the flu viruses that we're worried about, the H5N1 avian flu, that we're all worried about mutating and beginning to go person to person instead of bird to bird, the only way we can think about that as virologists is by using the evolutionary model. To think about how viruses change by mutation and then are selected for by the environment implies applying this model to viruses themselves. So all of this is incredibly fruitful and explains in a large way why science chose this as the breakthrough of the year. So what's then going on in terms of the response to this science that I just described?
Let me mention that Marty and I did not actually get into the controversy of over evolution because we were interested in it. We were actually interested in something quite different, and I'll say something about that later. We were interested in the theological question about suffering and violence within the natural world. And as we began with a team of scholars in Berkeley to study this, we thought, well, you know what, we just need to understand what the controversy is about. Let's meet the people who are involved in the controversy, and then we'll get back to our main topic. So what happened is we spent a few years talking to people, reading the literature, and we have tried to map what we think is the controversy, and you can see it here on the spectrum. Our subject matter is divine action, that is to say, how is it that God acts in the natural world? And we have this spectrum on one end, God as an interventionist. In the case of the creationist, God acts at the beginning to create the world. Or in the case of intelligent design, you've got more of an interventionist position here, in which a world already created has saltations that move it along. On the far end, we have the atheist position. Of course, there's going to be no divine action there because there's no God at all. And here we put Marty. Marty wants to go into the laboratory and do his research and to look for natural causes of natural phenomena. And he doesn't want an ideological materialism at that particular point, nor is he looking for God in the equations when he does that kind of research. What we want to do now is just kind of walk you through our spectrum a little bit. We're going to spend a fair amount of time with the creationists and the intelligent design people, and then finish up with the theistic evolutionists. As I've already said, there seems to be an intrinsic, intrinsic is really wrong, isn't it? There seems to be a historical connection between Darwinism and atheism, and the atheists really want to see themselves locked in battle against the church. But what's characteristic of the point of view is that the only reality is the physical reality. There is no transcendent spiritual reality to that. And the commitment to the Darwinian interpretation of life begins to take on religious dimensions. Julian Huxley even begins to give voice to this in 1959 at the centennial of the publication of Darwin's Origin. And note what he says: the evolutionary vision is enabling us to discern what the limits of a new religion, a naturalism. Let me call Marty back to describe his playing on the internet a couple days ago.
Don't go away, Ted. We were in Adelaide a few days ago, and we were preparing this same kind of talk for the forum we were involved in. And I was online just reading some journals, and I found in June 21st issue of Nature a report on the proposal that has been made to make Downhouse, that is Darwin's house in Kent, a National World Heritage Site. And the British government has withdrawn that proposal because the UNESCO committee is not looking favorably on the proposal. And in the news report about it, a historian of science, James Moore at the Open University in Milton Keynes, who's a biographer of Darwin, said, and this is a quote from the article, "Muslims go to Mecca, Christians go to Jerusalem, and Darwinians go to Down." Mm-hmm. So if you have any doubt that there's a kind of religious overtone, there it is from this week's Nature.
Well, you're going to expect a religious reaction, and that's what we get with the creationists. And while Marty and I were saying to ourselves, we need to understand these people and try to understand them from their own point of view, on a couple of occasions we packed up our students and we flew to San Diego to spend some time at the Institute for Creation Research. And here in this picture you can see Henry Morris, recently passed away, but he's sort of the granddaddy of scientific creationism. Here's Dwayne Gish, who thought of himself as the bulldog of creationism, still does actually. This is one of our students, Marty Maddox is his name, and by coincidence, while I'm snapping this picture, Marty has just asked a theological question. And Dr. Morris responds by saying, "Oh, that's a theological question. We're not theologians. We're scientists. And it's true. Both Dr. Morris and Dr. Gish have PhDs in biochemistry from the University of California at Berkeley. They have no theological training. So they go on to distinguish between creationism that is scientific and biblical creationism. And the distinction they make is that biblical creationism argues against Darwinism on the grounds of the authority of the Bible. If the Bible says it, then that's the appeal to authority. So you have a direct conflict then between the interpretation of Scripture on the one hand and science on the other. However, the approach of the Institute for Creation Research is scientific creationism, and that means they offer scientific arguments against the Darwinian model. And I think this is extremely important to observe because they understand themselves as making scientific arguments. It's much too glib to read in a newspaper that this is a battle between science and religion. In our observation, there is nobody in the controversy who has a bad opinion of science. Everyone has a high opinion of science. And it's a question, really, of who science is going to win in the war. Dwayne Gish wrote a book called Evolution, The Fossils Say No. Note the title. It's Evolution, The Bible Says No. No, it's the fossils that say no. Well, not very many people read this book, so he wrote another one. Evolution, The Fossils Still Say No. Now, the kind of argument you get here is, Gish says, if the Darwinian model were true, and there really was a long period of time in which simple life forms gave way to more complex life forms, then what you would expect to see in the geological strata would be down at the lower levels fossils of very simple life forms, and as you go up the ladder of rock, which is also the ladder of time, the fossils would indicate increasingly more complex life forms, and then you would find fossil remains of human beings only at the very top. That's what the Darwinian model would predict, he says. However, what you actually find are the fossils of all life forms at all layers. Now, if you're a geologist, you might want to dispute that, but listen carefully to the kind of an argument it is. Is this an appeal to the authority of Scripture? No. It's an appeal to the evidence. Well, among other things, Gish says that dinosaurs and human beings were contemporary, so I decided to look into the matter and went to a place called the Paluxy Riverbed in Texas, and I got there at the right time. The water was low. I could walk in the limestone and see numerous footprints from various forms of dinosaurs, and there's a little sign there that said this footprint is 113 million years old. But I had heard from Dwayne Gish that there were human footprints there, and sure enough, we found what looks like human footprints. A couple of them was only 8 feet from a dinosaur footprint, and there's a little creationist museum in the area where they claim to have 60 some odd human footprints which are clearly contemporary with dinosaur footprints. And their argument is that this refutes the Darwinian theory. Well, I don't think it refutes the Darwinian theory at all. At most, it says human beings and dinosaurs were contemporary. And who knows? The standard model is dinosaurs died out 60 million years ago, and human beings are only a few thousand years old. Maybe a dinosaur, stray dinosaur, got... Are there any dinosaurs in Texas? Yeah. Be that as it may, again, what I want to emphasize, this is not an appeal to the authority of the Bible. This is an appeal to evidence. Let me just summarize the young earth creationist. This is one brand of creationism, but it's probably the most virulent and most forceful. And on the list of teachings is the doctrine of creation out of nothing. There's nothing special about that. Almost every Christian will hold to creation out of nothing. Most Jews and Muslims will as well. What is unique is the idea that the earth is only 10,000 or so years old, and that the species are fixed in origin. Marty and I found this to be one of the most puzzling teachings of the young earth creationists. It's very important that the species were fixed in their kinds at the beginning. The idea that evolution occurs doesn't seem to bother the creationists. You can see evolution under a microscope, so that's not a problem. The issue is, can you have evolution from one species to another? And the creationists say, no, only evolution within a species. Separate ancestry for humans and apes. This seems to have been a big issue right from Darwin's own time down to the present. And it's important to the creationists that you and I have a special creation as a human being. Flood geology, and I'm not going to go into that at the moment. One of the assumptions made by journalists is that creationists are fundamentalists. And so I wanted to look into that to see if in fact that's true. I'm sure that some creationists are fundamentalists, but as a theologian, my question is there an inextricable relationship between fundamentalist Christianity and creationism? Well, to answer that question, let's remind ourselves, what is fundamentalism? Well, fundamentalism, as the world knows it today, was actually born in America in 1910 at a national convention of Presbyterians. And these Presbyterians were asking the question, what are the fundamental Christian beliefs, the smallest number we can get, that define a Christian over against a non-Christian? And so they had a big debate, and five got elected. You know what they are? Number one, the inerrancy of Scripture, especially in its original documents, not the King James Version. The deity of Jesus Christ, with special emphasis on his being born of a virgin. Substitutionary atonement, that the death of Jesus is efficacious for the forgiveness of your and my sin and the promise of everlasting life. The physical resurrection of Jesus on Easter. And Jesus' miracle-working power. Well, you might want to know, what were the also-rans? What were those that got nominated and voted down? Well, there were four of them. Here they are. Natural depravity. If we have any Calvinists in the room, this is the view that you and I are born in sin and outside of God's grace, and we need God's grace to take a move towards us. Another one that had honorable mention but voted down was justification by faith. Now, I'm a Lutheran. That's my favorite doctrine. It didn't make it. Premillennialism. There were a number of premillennialists there, but it was not the majority. Finally, literal heaven and literal hell. Well, let's pause for a minute. Is there anything in here that is anti-evolution? Nothing. Is there anything in here that is anti-science? Nothing. In fact, a close look will show there's nothing here that even deals with the doctrine of creation. It's all in redemption. Weren't the fundamentalists ganging up against the scientists? No. Their enemy were liberal Protestants. That's who was on their mind. Benjamin Warfield at Princeton was the one, the theologian most influential in formulating the doctrine of scriptural inerrancy, and he was a Darwinist. He himself had grown up on a horse farm in Kentucky, had seen the breeding of horses, even edited a magazine on horse breeding. And from 1885 to 1905, he studied the Darwinian controversy, and by 1905, he was convinced Darwin was right. So here he has this very conservative understanding of Scripture, and he holds a grudging but still honest acceptance of the Darwinian model. From 1910 to 1917, a series of pamphlets were published called The Fundamentals. Two of the editors were Darwinists. So if we ask the question, is there an inextricable tie between the theology of fundamentalism and the Darwinian model of evolution? No, there's not. So if you want to fight the Darwinist model from the creationist position, it doesn't necessarily require a commitment to fundamentalism. Now, let's move down the spectrum from creationism to intelligent design.
So, first thing we want to say is that in spite of what the media says, intelligent design is not creationism. And I'll try to explain what I mean specifically by that when we look at some of the proponents. First of all, let's define what those people who support ID mean by intelligent design. And this definition here is culled from a number of writers. And what they say is that when we look at the natural world, we will see objects in the natural world or processes in the natural world that appear to be so complex in their formation that they could not be explained by any standard naturalistic model such as neo-Darwinism, and therefore that object or process must have had an intelligent designer. So this is particularly interesting in biology, where we actually see something that you can call design. This is a beautiful micrograph that I use in teaching. That's a cell sort of in that midpoint of mitosis where the chromosomes are separating just at anaphase. And the chromosomes here are decorated in a red dye, and the spindle fibers are decorated very nicely in fluorescein, that very green fluorescence you see. So when I show this, I'm looking at this in class, and I'll have a student ask me, well, what are those fibers and what do they do? Well, there's two answers I can give. Of course, I can give a structural answer. I can tell the student they're made of alpha and beta tubulin and how they assemble and disassemble and all of that. But really, what the student's asking me is, what do they do? And then I have to say something like this. Well, the spindle fibers ensure that the two daughter cells will have the proper chromosomes after division. I've just given a purpose for the spindle fibers. And what we say in philosophy is that I've given a teleological answer. Teleology means an answer that has purpose embedded in it. And in fact, it's not possible actually to give a non-teleological answer to the question, what do the spindle fibers do? Of course, science runs away from purpose, and we've been running away from it since David Hume suggested we should leave it out of the equation as one of our tasks, and rightfully so. Rightfully so. But here in biology, we see things that have a design. In fact, the only reason Darwin did his work is because he saw design in nature, and he was asking the question, what is a natural explanation for the occurrence of design? Not that he didn't see it. Of course he saw it. So, in fact, philosophers of science in the last century, in order to get away from this kind of teleological answer I give, invented another word called teleonomy. And they said, what you gave is a teleonomic answer. But what is that? Well, it's an answer that appears to have purpose, but really doesn't. So we're dancing around this issue of purpose. And where does that come into play? Well, in order to take you back and tell you about that, I need to go back to the work of Thomas Aquinas, who in the Middle Ages, in his work, having learned at the feet of Albert the Great, was dealing with the modern science of his day, which was Aristotelian philosophy and sort of an Aristotelian look at the world, just being rediscovered after Aristotle had been lost to the West but preserved in the Muslim world with the great thinkers like Ibn Rushd and Ibn Sina. And Aquinas was studying their writing and commenting on them along with Maimonides and thinking about Christian theology in the light of Aristotelian teachings. He wrote a lot of things, a lot of commentaries on philosophy, but two of the books that people most think about him for are books that were actually textbooks for seminaries, like Summa Theologica and Summa Contra Gentiles. And in these two books, Thomas made the point, in agreement with Maimonides and Ibn Sina and Ibn Rushd, you can't in principle know anything about God by reason. That faith is a gift, a grace, and that's the only way you have it. You can't arrive at that by natural reason. But, unlike Maimonides, he said, reason is God-given, so I can use it. Okay, so I'll use it to think about God. Now what I'll do, he said, is I'll think about God in analogous ways. I'll look at the natural world, and I'll see things in the natural world that lead me to make an analogy about what God must be sort of like. It's not God, but it's an analogy for God. So he wrote these five analogies. They're called the five ways of knowing something about God. And one of them is called the fifth way. And people over the centuries erroneously began to call this the argument from design. It was not. It was an argument from governance. He specifically said in the fifth way is taken from the governance of the world, not the design of the world. Or in Contra Gentiles, he said the whole operation of nature must be directed by some knowledge that is governed. He never said it's a design argument. And what did he mean by this fifth way? Well, what he meant is that there are two kinds of analogous ways of looking at the world. One way is to look at God's interaction with the world in the sense of bringing it in and into existence and sustaining it in existence. What is called in Latin creatio ex nihilo and creatio continua. And he said this is, he's going to call primary cause. He didn't mean that God is actually a cause in the world. You can't say that about God. Okay? Because that makes God a cause in the world that just can't be. That's impossible to say. But he said it's like God is primary cause, and everything else in the world is secondary to that. So all the natural processes that science looks at are in fact secondary causes. Okay? So Thomas was very clear about that, and science originally was very clear about what it was doing. Well, over the centuries, Thomas's writings get obscured and confused. And by the beginning of the 19th century, we see the publication of Natural Theology by William Paley, in which he describes walking across the moor and finding the watch on the ground and intuiting that this had to be designed, it couldn't have just occurred by accident. And of course, Dawkins picked up on that for his great title of that wonderful book, The Blind Watchmaker, which is really a well-written critique that he did. Our current-day proponents of this same view are people like Michael Behe, the biochemist at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania with Darwin's Black Box, and William Dembski's books, which are really the philosophical heart of the intelligent design movement. And I'm going to submit to you in my argument today that they have made a fundamental error in philosophical logic. Okay? In order to see this error, I just want to show you for a minute Thomas's complete fifth way argument. Then I don't want you to read the whole thing. In blue, I've highlighted what I want you to see, because what Thomas said was, we think about the governance of the world in the following way. We see things in the world that appear to behave as though they're moving towards some end or purpose. Just as, he said, and here comes the metaphor, just as an archer directs an arrow to its target. So he used the metaphor of an archer firing an arrow to a target. So let's see what that means. So let's think about an archer, an arrow in flight, and the target. If we take Thomas's metaphor, then the arrow in flight are the secondary causes. The archer is the primary cause, and the target is the purpose. Okay? So, in fact, if we're doing science, then science can only actually see the arrow. Science can't see the archer, and science can't see the target. Science's task, in fact, is to study the arrow in flight, measure its speed, its weight, its size, its angle, its trajectory, but it can't know the archer and it can't know the target. That's not part of the task because it's not secondary cause. If you want to see the archer or think about the archer and the target, then that's the task of philosophy and theology. So in fact, what the intelligent design proponents are doing are trying to collapse God back into secondary cause. And that's not possible. That's an error in logic. It's an error in philosophical understanding of God's action in the universe. So I'm going to submit that intelligence design is basically flawed at the beginning, and is not really science, but rather a philosophical position. And that's what the courts have agreed in the United States thus far. So where do we stand then? We've taken on creationism, we've taken on intelligent design. Let's see where Ted and I actually stand.
Well, let's go back to our spectrum. And there's no question that the really interesting people are the creationists, the intelligent design people. Now we're going to get to the boring ones, the theistic evolutionists. And the creationists and the intelligent design people we could describe as pretty tightly knit schools of thought. Oh yeah, there's a variety of people, but they do have a coherent and understandable position. What you get in this category of theistic evolution is a wide variety of individuals that don't really communicate with one another necessarily, and they don't have all, their positions are not entirely compatible with one another. We didn't actually know when we started what to name this group. We got the name in having lunch with Dr. Morris and Dr. Gish when Dwayne Gish said at one point, you know, those atheistic materialists, those godless evolutionists are bad, but what's worse are those theistic evolutionists. So afterward we thought, okay, I guess that's us. And basically what brings this group together is the double commitment, on the one hand, a strong commitment to the Christian faith, and then secondly, a commitment to the best science, and if that means the Darwinian model of evolution, then so be it. On the one end, I put Benjamin Warfield, whom I mentioned before, at the end of the 19th century, a strong biblical literalist, and he was able, in his own mind, to reconcile his understanding of Scripture with the Darwinian model. Sort of a begrudging, yeah, you're dragging me into this. At the far end would be Teilhard de Chardin. I'll say something about him in a moment. And then in the middle, a variety of positions of contemporaries who have various ways of uniting God's action in the natural world with variations in heredity and natural selection, which are the two principles in the Darwinian model. Perhaps the best known theistic evolutionist is Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, a Jesuit paleontologist, discovered the Peking Man in 1929. And Teilhard redid all of Christian theology into a grand evolutionary scheme in which there is built right into the evolutionary process what he called Christification. That is to say, the natural world is actually bearing us through leaps in being, through crossing certain thresholds to higher levels of consciousness, when finally at point omega, all of reality will share a consciousness with God. He's probably the most extreme in terms of marrying these two. Marty and I probably are somewhere between Teilhard on the one hand and Benjamin Warfield on the other. Let us summarize our own position, which we consider one option within the larger group, and then I'll try to discuss with you some of the ideas that we think need to appear on the theologian's list. As I've already indicated, we think that it's inherent in the Christian faith that the best science be pursued. Why? Well, if the God whom we believe is the creator of all things created this world, and the scientists are the ones who understand this world the best, then we want only the best understanding. In addition to that, we also think God created the human race with curiosity, and the sciences do the best job, so to speak, of putting that to work. We think that this distinction from St. Thomas on between primary causation and secondary causation helps a lot in permitting the Christian scientists to allow scientific explanations to be limited to natural causes only. I'll say something about eschatology in a moment. We, over against intelligent design people, do not expect to find purpose in nature, but there definitely is a purpose for nature. It's hard to be a Christian and not think that the natural world doesn't have purpose. What I'm going to focus on in the next few slides is the theology of the cross and resurrection, but let me point out the final item on our list is science's vocation. We think it can be an authentic expression of one's Christian faith to give your life to scientific research. One of the negative fallouts of this controversy is that many young people go off to the university and they are afraid that science will take them away from their faith. And we would like to see something different. We would like to see faith embracing science, pursuing it with some courage, and to see the pursuit of knowledge and the sharing of that knowledge as one form of secular Christian vocation. Now to the issue that bothers us. We are not going to give you a solution. We're going to tell you the kinds of questions that we like to ask. If the Darwinian model is an accurate description of 3.8 billion years of evolutionary history on this particular planet, and if it is riddled from beginning down to the present time with predation and with extinction, what Charles Darwin himself wrestled with when he called it all waste, then we really have a theological agenda ahead of us. You can tell by the way we ask this question that we're inspired by Richard Dawkins. His first book in 1976 was The Selfish Gene. I won't go into that right now. But the question is, did God really design this long history of evolution replete with its predation and suffering and waste, or is there another way to think about it? Theology finds the natural world important, but the natural world does not supply us with our theology. Our faith is born out of history, and specifically the history of the death and the resurrection of Jesus. So we ask the following question. Is it reasonable to start with what we know about God in the revelation and the cross and the resurrection and move from that towards the natural world? When we think about the death of Jesus, what we think of is, of course, he was a victim of bad politics and human maleficence. And the wounds that he suffered were human inflicted. That's a historical event. But note this painting by Matthias Grünewald, the Eisenheim altarpiece. And as you look at the body of Jesus here, it's not just the wounds in his hands and his feet that become obvious, but his body is just riddled with pockmarks. Jesus is suffering here from the plague. And this particular painting appeared in a place where victims of the plague, when going to worship, knowing they're going to die, could see this particular painting. Well, what's going on? Well, the artist Grünewald is saying Jesus is suffering from something natural, not just something sinful, but something natural as well. Now, if a Trinitarian Christian believes that the experiences of Jesus are part of the inner life of God, then is God experiencing the suffering of the natural world? I think that's a reasonable question to ask. Does the theology of the cross lead us in that direction? What is important in Christian theology is that things change and that God has made a promise that the future will be different from the past. The resurrection of Jesus on Easter is God's promise that there is a new creation coming. How do we image the new creation? Well, let's go back to Isaiah and his vision of the peaceable kingdom. May remember this passage. And we have, among other things, the lion lying down with the lamb. That is to say, all of nature will relate to one another in a way that's different from what it is that it has been transpiring in the past. Martin Luther was once asked, Martin, do you believe that eventually, eschatologically, we'll have the peaceful kingdom in which the lion will lie down with the lamb? He says, oh yeah, of course I believe that, but you might have to put in a new lamb each day. Well, the natural world that we observe is not this one. Yet, this is the vision. Is it possible to think that the natural world that we have inherited is but a step along the way in God's continuing creative process, which is not yet over? Well, theistic evolution, here we are. We've got a future yet to come. Don't mistakenly think that Marty and I believe in a doctrine of progress. We don't. When we use the word entelechy and eschatology, those two words, we want to say that God's promise, God's eschatological promise for transformation, is what gives us a world orientation. But it's not something you can see, at least in its fullness, in the natural world as we have it. We don't believe the world is just simply getting better and better automatically or naturally. Rather, the peaceable kingdom will have to be a divine act, similar to the act of raising Jesus from the dead on Easter. That's our program for this evening.